Welcome to a Tuesday edition of Presidio Bitcoin Jam.
Tuesday. Yeah, unusual timing.
Well, Good to be back. We missed last Friday. We're missing this Friday.
And we might miss next Friday. Not because we don't love this show.
We love the show.
We have various travel plans and other conflicts.
Well, I don't want to dox y'all, like your various activities, but we were getting a little bit of...
like Steve always says, I'm not going to say who it is.
But anything that you're willing to volunteer, because I haven't heard all of the updates of your activities.
Nope. Mainly, I got sick, so I'm hopefully at the end of a cold right now.
Okay.
That might affect my on-air voice, though.
I also saw Steve clock an Ethereum dude, but
that wasn't a dream, actually.
Your vision quest. And yeah, I've been still recovering from some strange dehydration stuff. Starting to feel a lot better, but it was a strange birthday season. But one birthday present I'm proud of from my dad is this sick Reptar shirt. Reptar rocking San Francisco. So that's
cool.
Do you know who Reptar is?
No.
I did not know.
Are you serious? Bro, both of you guys are showing your age right now. Come on, homie.
He's like, I don't know the Sam Smith guy you guys are talking about.
Apple Pay, what's that? Reptar was the famous dinosaur in the Rugrats. So early 90s, Nickelodeon. That was a big deal. Yeah, well.
You can't do that on television?
Different eras. This was like you guys explaining to me the history of Sun Microsystems. All right. Anyhow, Reptar is dope. Yeah, and I have some stuff coming up, which maybe I'll share about after. It'll be more interesting.
Oh, okay. That hasn't happened yet.
No.
When does that start?
Theoretically tomorrow.
Whoa.
Yeah. So okay. Next time I'm here, I'll have hopefully some good things to share.
Cool. I want to give a plug something really quick before we get into all the amazing topics we have. But hacknation.ai is an upcoming hackathon. I think I talked about it once in the show, but I'm going to mention it again. Hack-nation.ai is the website. Mm-hmm. Spiral is sponsoring a challenge at this hackathon. It's a global hackathon. It's the fifth edition of it. There's thousands of participants, so it's a big hackathon.
International, right?
International. It accommodates developers and builders and hackers who are remote, and there's about a dozen physical hubs around the globe, including we're going to host one right here at Presidio Bitcoin.
Sweet.
So in the Bay Area, there's both Stanford and Presidio Bitcoin are hosting hubs. I think there's one in Cambridge at MIT and New York City, and then other cities throughout the world. I'm excited. Spiral's sponsoring one of the 12 design challenges. Ours, of course, is around Bitcoin payments. It's a bit of a risk or opportunity for Spiral because we do Bitcoin events. So everyone there is already a Bitcoiner and we're just trying to like show off our stuff that we do in Bitcoin. Here we're entering a hackathon where the vast majority, if not almost all, are not Bitcoiners, people who don't work on Bitcoin. So we need to, it'll be a challenge for us to get our challenge to be accepted by participants, because participants choose which of the 12 challenges to work on.
And the challenges are like topical tracks or so?
I don't know what no one knows.
Okay.
They're not shared until the day of. Mm. So, I mean, I can say like at a high level what ours is, it'll be around how can AI agents earn money and like through Bitcoin to Lightning Network.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
but I don't know what the other design challenges are, but they won't be around money, Bitcoin, stablecoins, cryptocurrency. The only money one that I'm aware of is ours.
I love it.
The others will be other types of AI challenges. But we need to, we have to like sell our challenge and attract people to work on it. So that'll be fun to see how well we do at that. And again, we're not pitching to Bitcoiners. We're pitching to people who aren't into Bitcoin. So I think it'll be hard, but we'll learn a lot from it. And I think it's really important for Bitcoin to take on that type of challenge. And then hopefully we get really good projects and great results and learn a lot from that
experience.
So are you
going to be presenting something about Bitcoin or the challenge to the group? Like how are people going to understand what...
Yeah, so the day of... So it's Saturday, April 25th. Mm-hmm. And it's global, but at least in California time, it starts at 8 a.m. that Saturday. And I think 9:15, everyone globally is synced and there's like a 12 1-minute pitches on the challenges. Mm-hmm. So we may or may not have a VIP to give our pitch.
Steve Lee coming through.
But much more VIP than me. And so that'll hook people. Then there's like a 2-minute video, and we have like a, you know, multi-page like description of the design challenge. And we have a special prize as well for our design challenge, which I won't reveal, but again, it'll be a unique type of prize that others won't be able to replicate. But yeah, then they'll choose which challenge they want to work on. And we'd like to give Bitcoin away to participants who choose our challenge. A small amount, just to, so there's not friction in terms of them getting a wallet, accessing Bitcoin, etc. We just want to make that friction free. Should be good.
And you have people building directly on mainnet? Is that, like, if they're kind of new to Bitcoin, would it be appropriate to
It's the only way to go, man.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Production is test.
Mainnet, only way to go. And that's what we learned through the Flint community and all the work I know all of us have done and others. I think that's the best way to go. You don't have to spend big bucks, right? I mean, if we give like $25 to each project, that should be plenty for demonstrating what they're trying to build.
Or hold it in its generational wealth.
And then Sunday, it's basically a 24-hour hackathon on the next day, Sunday. They'll be judging, and DK has volunteered to be a judge, so thank you. And there's a couple others from
if my thing falls through, maybe I'll come through as well.
A couple other folks from the Goose project who also volunteered to judge. So we've got three super high quality judges, and I think you guys will be judging. Not literally every project, but you won't be judging just our challenge, but it'll be a diverse set of challenges, and I assume you get some subset of the projects, because I think they anticipate 1,500 to 2,000 hackers.
Wow, that's great.
In terms of who actually, you know, once who shows up, how many, and then like if teams and stuff, probably several hundred projects.
But the 1,500, that's like the global number, not the
global
expected, California. Yeah.
Do you have to be a human to participate?
I don't know if that's stipulated in there.
Interesting. Well, then you might need to prepare, as Matt says. I mean, here, you got a nice bribe. You might want to make sure you've got some DDoS prevention.
Oh, yeah. Well, we do need to think through, I mean, not just, we don't want hackathon participants to take the Bitcoin and then work on another challenge, right? And then especially if we run out of Bitcoin and then the people who actually work in the project don't get any Bitcoin. So we need to tighten that up a little bit. If anyone has ideas,
maybe have a Bitcoin faucet.
Yeah.
I mean, we have some ideas. The problem with the faucet is they'll just drain it, right? So
I thought Square solved that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. You have to become a Cash App customer to
Sailor solve that. Infinite mind glitch. Actual question though, or proposal for the audience. If, as Steve said, it is not yet stipulated, and perhaps there's even a gray area here, I've got some ideas of things obviously I would love to see come out of this, and bummed I'm probably going to miss it, but I would love to see some enterprising person out there, perhaps the progenitor of Oribot or someone else, to come and have a bot participate. I would be extremely excited to see if at least one of our participants is an agent. That'd be cool.
That'd be cool.
That'd be fun. Yeah, I like that.
Okay, I think this hackathon, their main, or what they've had success with in the past and the people they have signed up already, is very good marketing to students globally. Mm. So they have thousands of people already signed up. And I think most our students are around the globe. They also have, there's already like dozens of people signed up to come to Presidio Bitcoin, like from Stanford and Cal and other local universities. So,
oh, really? Like, they're already confirmed they're coming here and not going to stay at Stanford.
Yeah.
That's great. I mean, yeah, they're gonna make the trip up.
There's also a healthy or a strong list for Stanford too, but specifically for this site. Cool. So,
that's great.
That's also, you know, a group of people that has been challenging to get interested in Bitcoin and get them to Presidio Bitcoin. We did a hackathon last May that you guys were at, and we had, we actually did quite a bit of outreach to Stanford and Berkeley. I think you even went and gave a talk, right? So
I preached the gospel.
But we, I think we had what, like one student show up or something. So
I thought we had a couple, but yeah, it was a lot.
You know, so that'll be another thing where it's risky, but a great opportunity. Risky in that we'll see what they do with Bitcoin and whether they even choose our design challenge. But it'll be nice to have them here.
Yeah. And regardless of, you know, who actually works on the design challenge or not, I mean, one thing I'm extremely convinced of, and I've seen, I think with 100% hit rate, anyone that comes to our office leaves with a positive impression of what we're working on. I don't think there's been a single person that has left with a non-positive impression. So even if these guys hack on something else, I think however many people come, that's a whole new cohort of people who are at least like, Bitcoin is interesting. These guys are not scammy.
Yep.
Seems like they're trying to build something cool.
Yep. I agree. So,
great. So win. Nice job, Steve.
Hack-nation.ai if you're interested. You don't have to be a student. Like, if you work in industry, or you're more than welcome to come as well.
You could be like DK, student of the game.
You know? True.
Where should we start?
We have a lot to do.
We've got three items in the title, but I think we had all kinds of items that, hey, let's talk about this. We had so many things, kind of flurry of activity in the chat. So do you want to start with some quick fire stuff? You want to get right into quantum or
Iran?
Or
AI. You
know, yeah.
All three.
Okay.
So I guess this probably isn't going to take that long, but I guess it was about a week ago with the war in Iran, the Bitcoin relevant piece was that, you know, Iran was...
First rule of PBJ, never discuss the title. I love that.
Yeah. was, you know, doing a blockade... Basically, for I think my understanding from reports is that Iran has put mines in the Strait of Hormuz, except for in their national waters, forcing ships to go through their national waters, and then they're extracting a toll. They're asking for a fee. And the notable part about this to Bitcoin is that it was reported that they're requiring Bitcoin. Now, I've seen other reports saying that they accept Chinese yuan and stable coins as well. Unclear what the truth is, but at least to the extent that it's true that they accept Bitcoin, that's super notable to Bitcoin. I think it's like one of the more...
It's like the biggest news in
Bitcoin. It's an interesting one because it's controversial in the sense that, like, you know, at least for someone in the West or in America, like, it's not super exciting to fund, you know, potentially like nuclear development program in Iran or whatever. But in terms of if you look at Bitcoin as money and what it offers for the world, for people who for years have said, what's the use case of Bitcoin? Yeah. I mean, this is like a very clear example of, you know, a country that where the dominant currency of the day, dollar, does not work well for them. They've had economic sanctions for a long, long time. I forget, you know, decades or whatever. And you know, there's also a lot of Bitcoin analysis and narrative around the petrodollar and Bitcoin becoming the world reserve currency one day. And it's events like this which are stepping stones towards that future. So I find it fascinating that's even like being discussed.
Yeah.
And then the details unclear, unclear if they actually are accepting Bitcoin, requiring it, how they're conducting it. Like, is it on chain only? And if they're doing on chain, it was reported that they want to see it within seconds, or that would require zero confirmations.
Or they're using Lightning Network.
Which would totally work, but that means they're either running their own Lightning node and managing that, or working with a provider or whatever. So fascinating.
Yeah. And isn't it true that they are they known to be a nation state that does Bitcoin mining at the nation state level?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen. I mean, again, I don't know what all is like 100% confirmed, but there have been people that have done analysis of like where miners are. I think they had almost 1% of hash rate at some point. I don't know exactly, but I think it's pretty well established that they've been mining.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't read the details, but I think I saw it like chain analysis or some kind of report, which does chain analysis, suggested that they were already doing like billions of dollars of activity with Bitcoin.
Of mining activity?
I don't know. Okay. But volume of something, right? So I don't think they're new to Bitcoin. I mean, To anyone who understands Bitcoin, it seems obvious that any country that is under duress from like U.S. economic sanctions would be wise to study Bitcoin. So wouldn't surprise me.
I would love to better understand, and maybe that's, I don't know if either of you guys have any more details. My understanding was late last week, you know, there was a ceasefire, and as a result of the ceasefire, they were requesting this, you know, quickly paid toll. Bitcoin was one of the currencies reported, maybe yuan, maybe stablecoins as well. Although I would have a very hard time believing stablecoins, because we know that Tether can, yeah, or whatever, can freeze, yeah, the dollars, and they have in the past. So I would have a hard time believing that, but maybe if they get it instantly and convert it back into something like Bitcoin or yuan. Either way, that's interesting. But then, I mean, honestly, I've been mostly staying off Twitter, so I have very, very little context. It seems like a bit of a circus and a clown show right now, which I think is kind of the purpose. But then it looks like the U.S. was going to blockade the blockade. So
just an additional toll booth, I think, right?
Is there an additional toll? So
I
double
it was
toll?
Like you get through like the...
No, there's no... U.S. isn't charging money.
That we know
U.S.
of.
Is stopping ships.
Oh, it's a separate blockade filter. Okay.
Well, unless you pay Melania.
It's not a... they're not allowing ships to pass.
Joking.
At least they're not... I think U.S. is not allowing ships that pass through the Iranian waters to pass. And since I believe there's still mines in the international waters, that means no one's passing. Or at least, I'm sure the U.S. would allow like a U.S. friendly ship, mm-hmm, to pass, but not, mm-hmm, non-U.S. friendly ships to pass.
So that leaves me with a couple of many big questions. The first question is, I will put this out to the audience as well. Do we have any confirmed evidence of a single Bitcoin transaction actually going through for this? Obviously, if it's Lightning, that would be potentially impossible to tell, or very close to impossible. If it's on-chain, still tricky. And I know a lot of people, including some of your Ori's, have been looking into this a little bit. But I'm curious if we have any evidence of that. And if not, with this new blockade, I mean, I can't imagine the U.S. is going to blockade, for example, a Chinese ship. Like, I just...
The reports are they have.
Well, I mean, that just seems like, okay, like a hot war is pretty imminent there, which would be way, way, way worse than just an economic warfare. Do we have any evidence to believe this has happened, or it's going to continue to happen, or is it still extremely speculative at this point? Anyone in the audience?
I'm not aware of evidence.
Yeah. Is your evidence only vibes?
A couple interesting things that I took away from it. One is, you know, historically, when you have like, when you're operating a mining operation, you actually have like costs that you have to like convert because your bills are, and you know, your bills are maybe denominated in some other currency. But when you're setting up a toll booth, you don't really have any costs. So it's the kind of thing where you could choose to take it and hold it. You don't have to pay for the energy. The other thing is I thought it was interesting that the unit of account was still US dollars. It's $1 per barrel. So it's, you know, we often talk in terms of Bitcoin, or you often talk in terms of sats. We try to avoid that. But this is
talk in terms of jewels, bro.
This is in terms of dollars, but actually settled in Bitcoin, which I thought was kind of...
J-E-W-E-L-S or J-O-U-L-E-S?
The latter.
Yeah.
Either could do.
I was thinking... Anyway.
Bling, draped up, draped out.
Anyway, that was all.
It was your question, though?
Well, it wasn't so much a question, but I thought it was interesting that we spend so much time talking about Bitcoin as kind of like both the settlement and the unit of account, and it's rare that I hear people talk about U.S. dollar as the unit of account for a transaction that is meant to be settled in Bitcoin.
I see.
That seemed like a novel thing to me that I can't remember seeing before.
Yeah.
One question I have on that. I mean, it is interesting. It makes sense to me. Like, to your point, I don't think any of us ever believed it was actually going to happen overnight. Like, it's going to be many steps. So like, if all of the world is accustomed to paying for everything in dollars for, you know, as long as they've effectively been alive or working, I think it makes sense that you still denominate what people know and just say, hey, this is the asset we take. Here's how you get it. One thing that was more interesting to me, though, was that at least initially when I read it, I didn't see yuan. I saw yuan later. But it's interesting that they're offering two alternatives, because if it was really just like Iran and China becoming like super tight on this, they could just be like, you have to pay in yuan. U.S. petrodollar is basically over, and that's that. So it's kind of interesting to me, and it makes me question why. I mean, is the reason that it's harder to get you on? And, you know, Bitcoin's obviously extremely liquid, super network effects. Anyone, anywhere could get it. They don't want to completely sort of like break face with the US, you know, entirely at this point, or, you know, US allies. Or is it perhaps, you know, the like six-dimensional chess that China also is interested in moving to a Bitcoin standard eventually?
I do wonder how for other countries who don't really have an angle on this, they just simply want to get their ship through or whatever.
Yeah.
If it's if access to Bitcoin is just dramatically easier than yuan.
Yeah.
I could see that being
like a Swift
I could see that
system.
Being incredible.
Probably such a
because a lot of like a lot of
China established a SWIFT system pretty recently, I think they've got like 100 plus countries signed up.
Okay.
So it's not nothing, but
yeah, I don't know how hard it is for many countries to access yuan, and especially access yuan if the US based global financial system is blocking that or something, right?
Mm-hmm. So and that I mean that to me would be another to your point big piece of this story is, you know, piece number one is, like you said, people are asking for a use case for Bitcoin. I mean, the use case for most normies that don't understand or want to really dig into inflation, sort of blah, blah, blah. The use cases, for better or for worse, have always been, you know, Bitcoin is a way to circumvent laws you don't agree with. And that's a pretty way of saying it. You know, it shows the sort of moral relativity, I guess, of most things, right? Where Bitcoin's first big use case for normies that were not in the Ron Paul camp was Silk Road. That was circumventing laws that those people didn't agree with. Secondly, you have another administration that's using it to circumvent laws they didn't agree with. But I think the second big thing to what this says to me is that, for better or for worse, Bitcoin is mature enough that a government trusts it, and more importantly, liquid enough. Because I think whenever you hear anyone say, and I was actually listening to a podcast yesterday, and it was kind of interesting around Circle and payments and stuff, and the Circle dude was still, he's like, well, I'm still not sure it's going to be Bitcoin. Proof of work is interesting, but, you know, maybe there's something with this compute stuff. And I'm like, bro, it's, and he was actually smarter than I expected and talked about like free banking and some interesting stuff with stablecoins. But like, if I just like had to like highlight one thing for anyone in Silicon Valley or anywhere else, it's like, well, kind of like the idea, but I don't know if it's going to be Bitcoin. It's like the network effects at this point are so deep. The liquidity is so deep for anything to catch it right now, other than, you know, the dollar, maybe the yuan. It just seems pretty much impossible, absent AI coming creating their own, which is, you know, our black spot we've talked about. But anyways.
Cool. Anything else on? Yeah. So summary, I'd say it's at least conceptually a big event. Unclear if it's actually being utilized. And in terms of whether it persuades people on Bitcoin, it really depends. I mean, a lot of people would be like, yeah, see, I told you Bitcoin's just used for evil or bad things.
Yeah.
It won't really move the needle. Other people would be like, wow, it's actually used on the geopolitical stage.
I mean, to that though, I think it's worth really putting some focus on what's going on there, because, you know, you sort of say for circumventing laws, which sounds bad, but it's like, got some people who make laws that, you know, what is a law? A law is some group of people decided it should go a certain way.
Right.
And so the idea that, like, sometimes we say Bitcoin is for enemies, it's like money for enemies. It's like, you don't have to be friendly with somebody and you can still transact. That's, I think, the underlying story here. And it's just that, you know, it's not that you have to be supportive of the Iran thing and against the US, not at all. It's just that there's a first example of desperation where people are enemies, you know, maybe about to go to a serious war, but this still becomes the currency. So if you say, in a multipolar world, a world where there's lots of different people and you don't have one protectorate of the whole globe, that's kind of the case for Bitcoin.
I totally agree. There's definitely a camp of people, and I speak to a lot of them in Silicon Valley, who maybe have a worldview of like US good, like enemies evil, and then like Bitcoin, the only thing they've ever heard of Bitcoin being useful for is like bad evil
stuff.
Things and doesn't benefit them or Americans. And so it's not super marketable to persuade that group of people.
I think one thing that I would maybe hammer harder there, and something that you mentioned with this hackathon organizer when we had our lunch that I thought was really good, because I got the impression when you were speaking with Hope that she was not anti-Bitcoin, but was kind of still skeptical and had some questions. It seems generally like doing bad things, blah, blah. But I thought the your explanation with her was very effective and very good, which is comparing Bitcoin to the internet as a protocol. And I think that the more you said, listen, you know, the point of Bitcoin is not that you or any of us support circumventing laws. Individual companies or nation states can certainly enforce those in the same way that Block is not going to let you send a Bitcoin payment to Iran. They have OFAC lists and they're not going to do that. That's great. And individual US companies and countries can make those decisions. But the actual base underlying protocol, trying to say to restrict the transfer of the base protocol would be like trying to say we're going to restrict the transfer of packets on the internet. And I don't think it's just a moral argument. I actually think it's like a sort of like utility or like necessity argument. And I think what it comes down to is global information is so big and global markets are so big that unless you accept that like half of the internet is being used for things you probably don't like, but without that half of the internet never could have taken off because you wouldn't have gotten the necessary liquidity and network effects for that. And I think it's almost like recognizing like the world is complex. There's a shadow side to a lot of things. You may or may not like a lot of those things that are happening. In fact, you can detest them, but you would never get scale, network effects, and liquidity if you didn't embrace all that is humanity and soon to be agents. Yep.
Which I don't want to skip ahead necessarily to Mythos, but I'm going to ask the question, like, what is the purpose of a nation state and will they exist 50 years from now?
Oh, we're really going to get into that?
Well, it's very funny you raise that question for many reasons. I just this morning, in preparation for this podcast and also to finally edify my own curiosity, I chatted with Claude, which, by the way, I'm more and more Claude pilled by the day, and basically asked Claude to work with me. And like, maybe this will turn its way into, it's certainly going to come into an LP update. Maybe it will come into an essay as well, to kind of like refactor the sovereign individual thesis with what's happening with AI.
Cool. Are you using nerfed Claude or full?
He doesn't
Claude.
Get the real stuff. Yeah. Raw dog Claude?
Probably not, man. I'm certainly not big enough to have the raw dog Claude. I wish. If you know anyone that can hook a brother up, like,
public nerfed Claude.
Yeah, public nerfed
we can
Claude.
Talk about.
Yeah, sadly, I'm not VIP enough to be on that super duper list. But
that's not what I'm talking about. Claude. Public Claude got dumbed down recently.
This is an important topic we should talk about.
Yeah, we should talk about it,
but we'll come to that in a minute. Yeah. I thought you meant the Mythos model itself, but okay. So yes, I'm using public nerfed Claude and certainly not the super duper Mythos. But it was interesting because we went back and forth on this. And, you know, I've seen more and more people, I think the backdrop for people to understand this is Anthropic in particular. Their revenue numbers are just mind-numbing and insane. And I think someone posted a tweet showing now, I think they're at like $30 billion or more. And like the gist was, if they keep at their current growth rate, they're going to like outpace Google by the end of the year and the US federal government by mid next year. So just to give you a scale of what we're talking about, that's fucking insane. And like 3 years ago, this company barely existed. And so if that doesn't AGI pill you, I'm not really sure what will. But what's interesting to me about that is I was like, okay, well, if this thing is completely taking off and the other ones are kind of taking off with it, but I think they're in a league of their own at this point, then if it really does challenge Google and then eventually the US federal government, where does that leave us in the next couple of years, right? And on the one hand, I think all of us, either explicitly or implicitly, are fans of the sovereign individual. I would say Bitcoin is probably the most sovereign individual technology that's ever existed, other than maybe the internet itself. And the whole thesis that book laid out, if you haven't read it, it was from the late 90s, highly recommend it. The general gist of it is that from the microprocessor to, I guess, the beginnings of the internet when they were writing, technology moved in such a way that it changed the logic of violence and the changed logic to favor defense, i.e. with cryptography, specifically cryptography, it became easier for one individual that had access to this magical fact about the universe, which is generally that it's easier to multiply than it is to divide. That gave the individual the ability to safeguard their own information in the information age on par with the states and the corporations. That's a really, really, really big idea. And the second order consequence of that idea was thus people that were extremely well positioned to use this technology could now effectively engage in commerce and produce without having tax or whatever you want to call it, a body that was not engaging in anything productive at all, but was literally saying, pay us this toll or we're going to come and like hurt you effectively. And it now changed that asymmetry where people could effectively create great value in a way that a robbing gang could no longer rob them. And so the next order of that was the people that were, they called it the cognitive elite, which I think is very interesting they chose that word. But that the cognitive elite and the people that were able to use these tools would basically flee geographic locations where their bodies were still subject to violence, start off in cyberspace and then relocate to geographies that treated them more like a friendly, you know, whatever, a company or something, like someone basically saying, we'll give you a better deal. We're not going to like beat you up for half of your take. We're going to, you know, whatever, take 10%. And you're actually going to get like healthcare and services and things like that. And so in the long
term, makes the land more like the governments who control the land and defense become more competitive with each other to try to attract citizens.
Exactly. And so it becomes more of a market for services. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying this is all perfect or that I agree with all of this. There are certainly cases where I think there are some blind spots, like what does happen to people that aren't, quote unquote, the cognitive elite. And there's a lot of questions. I'm not saying it's moral panacea, but that was kind of the logic of all technology from the internet and Bitcoin. Okay. And by the way, this is kind of like people always joke, this is like Balaji's like source code or whatever. And like when he talks about the network state and people moving like this, it's just
like rebranding.
He's just rebranding the sovereign individual for like Gen Z, which is funny, I guess.
Yeah,
it's a good package. Now, AI is a very, well, it remains to be seen where we go. And this is the fascinating debate, right? You know, Peter Thiel famously said, AI is centralizing crypto, Bitcoin is decentralizing. It's going to be interesting to see those two things go up against each other. If you're super AGI-pilled and you see companies like Anthropic revving to potentially hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue next year, or maybe even trillions, and they become the most powerful economic entities on the face of the planet, then the big question, the fundamental question is, how quickly do the open source models, which can run at the edge and potentially empower individuals or potentially turn anyone into a cognitive elite, although there's probably still a cognitive elite that will use them more effectively. If the open source models keep track with companies like Anthropic, then I would say sovereign individuals' thesis stands, it's on steroids. If, however, you believe that these models like Mythos, even if open source is close, they're going to be able to unlock just capabilities, particularly around violence, both in the world and in cyberspace, i.e. hacking and attacking, so much further ahead than even the open source models that are only 6 months behind or whatever, then that would radically, in my opinion, just like flip the sovereign individual on its head, because now you would have these new super, super, superpowers that basically would control the net. And so in that world, though, then the next question becomes, well, power is certainly centralizing there, but is it centralizing to the nation state? Well, maybe not. I mean, Anthropic is based in the United States. These companies like Google, XAI are based in the United States. So in theory, you know, the U.S. would be the one to kind of like work with them. And, you know, the U.S. still basically has the guns, so they're going to listen to them. But you could also see a world where like these dudes are like, you know what? Fuck it. We are the Somali pirate. Like we're the government now. And maybe they relocate or maybe they have multiple instances in countries around the world. I think it's super hard to predict, but that's the setup. I'm not claiming where I think it's going to go other than to say short term, I would not bet against the centralized providers. Long term, though, I do think technology follows waves of going big and going small. And I still think sovereign individual plays out. But is it in 5 years, 15 years, 100 years? Hard to say.
I love what you laid out. And in fact, I had goosebumps during part of that. I'm like, yes.
The first goosebumps. Wow.
My man.
I love that framing and positioning, but I will say it's quite abstract. And so one kind of near-term concrete thing that we've seen happen, I think we may have even talked about it, the whole, I think, Department of War, Anthropic kerfluffle, right? Did we talk about that here?
A little, I don't know, but...
You know what I'm talking about or no?
You haven't seen it, just ask Anthropic.
That, I think, is like one step toward a concrete version of that. Like if you have CEO, Dario Amodei, and he gets to say, you're allowed to use my technology in this way and you're not allowed to use it that way. He says that to the Department of War.
Right.
He is basically saying, I control the military.
Right.
He's not saying it explicitly, but that's what's happening. Right.
Right.
And he's an elected official and there's no term limits. And that becomes a weird world to live in. But not, it doesn't strike me that that's particularly unlikely.
Are there historical examples of a private company in America having technology that the government wants and they don't sell it to the government? Or is this unprecedented?
Well, I don't know about America, but I would say maybe one precedent is I've been going down the Buckminster Fuller rabbit hole again recently. I highly recommend, like, in terms of people that saw the future, this dude's certainly, he's way up there. And he has a book called Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth. Critical Path is another one. And then I just reread The Grunch of Giants. I recommend them all. But The Grunch of Giants. It's basically his critique of multinational capital.
Oh.
Fabulous. Fabulous. But in fact, I got a copy. It may even be in my backpack. But like, one of his claims is that the nation states have never really been in power. And so he has this concept that the world has actually been run by great pirates, the majority of whom we don't know the name of. And the great pirates, basically that his gist is that the world is a very complex place and we conduct science in all forms, experiments to figure out basically the laws of nature, the laws of physics, whatever, to figure out what works. And there are some people in history that have been adventure-seeking, cognitive elite, whatever words you want to use, that have had better models of the world. And the best example, like, that I would say it's a similar level of technology, in my opinion, to AI, would be seafaring in the seafaring age, whatever mm-hmm. that was, like the 1600s or something, I guess. And basically, people that had the ability to sail around the world and visit different ports were able to understand things like that the world is not flat, it's round. We're able to understand things like every society has a different set of moral norms and laws, which led them to essentially realize that all of that is relative. And you know, not to jump ahead of myself here, but when you think, he called these people the great pirates. And if you think of who's the great pirate of today, it's like, who's the one guy that always says everything in the world is negotiable except for physics? Elon. And that's basically what the pirates realized, is that all laws and customs were just like kind of arbitrary relative to a place. What mattered, the one thing they couldn't get around was, you know, if you don't know how to sail by the stars or operate your ship, you die. So you can't cheat on physics. And so his argument is effectively that these, you know, Uber, whatever, Minch, great pirates basically set up puppet states around the world. It's a little conspiratorial, but it's a Bitcoin podcast, so hey. And basically they put up puppet kings and would encourage the populace, including especially the intelligent populace, to go to school and specialize, because you wanted people to be very specialist. The more specialized you were, the less likely you were to see how nature and the world actually worked. And so they encouraged that. And one would argue that that legacy lives on today. Now, he argues the great pirates sort of died off around, I guess, World War I, maybe coming into World War II, because technology got so advanced that, particularly when we were getting down eventually to the atomic level, it was impossible for any of these great pirates to have a sort of comprehensive view of how everything worked. I would argue that's definitely not the case, and that there were certainly great pirates of the internet age. And I mean, they're pretty like standing right in front of you in terms of the AI age of people that understand the tech stack up and down. Elon would be certainly the greatest example of this. And so back to your question, Steve, what he argued was that, like, you know, when we said it was like the British Empire that was ruling the world, it wasn't actually the British Empire. It certainly wasn't the British people. It was the sort of like pirates that controlled the technology of seafaring. And one great example of that, some we don't know the name of, but others would be corporations. And one great example of a corporation like that would be the East India Company. And one would argue that maybe the East India Company would be the best, in my opinion, from what I understand right now, analog to a company like an Anthropic or a SpaceX today.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
a lot there to go into, but...
Yeah, well, a related tangent, though. I mean, something we discussed last week was just... I think I raised the question about the power that an Anthropic has or any of the frontier AI labs over other companies. So you have, you know, Block announcing that they're going all in on using AI mm-hmm. internally, Block 2.0. And I've seen firsthand now that it is radically changing. I'll share a few examples of stuff I've done recently that's pretty cool. But definitely dependent on the companies becoming dependent on AI. And I think we have an expectation that other companies are going to follow suit. So if you have eventually...
Is it AI from a single source provider?
Well, let's talk about that, right? Because that's...
Guess which one, DK?
That's unwise, right? So we'll talk about that. But But yeah, if you fast forward to maybe only a couple of years from now, like the S&P 500 will all be
Anthropic.
It will shift to this. Well, no, well, not if they're wise, but like I'm talking about shifting to this new model of how to run a company, regardless of which model you're using. But of course, you'll want the best models. And so the more you have set it up to depend on one company, one model, and there's a lot of switching costs, it puts you at a significant strategic risk, right? Because back to the nerfing of the model, well, what if a company switches to this whole new way of running their business? It's amazing.
Yeah.
They're getting results. They're seeing results. And then completely out of their control with no heads up at all, it's been nerfed and it's like it's been reduced by 2/3 of the capabilities of what you were just using. And you have like what power or control do you have? If you have, you know, if you're a large enough business, large enough revenue, you can probably call up the CEO and say like, hey, give us the good stuff. But what about small and medium-sized businesses? What if you don't have that type of relationship and that
power?
And
also, what if I can give you the good stuff, but it's going to cost 10x?
Yeah. And like you, the more dependent you are on a single provider, single model, you're hopeless there. I mean, you're completely dependent on them. So it seems like, I still think like the Block 2.0 model is the future for organizations. If you don't choose that model, you're going to be left behind. But if you choose that model, you definitely want to set yourself up so that you have, you can operate with multiple models. In the world we live in today, we're in a situation where there are multiple models that are all competitive with each other. It gets even
for now
scarier if one emerges and sustains that window. That's very scary. I just think that's like an enormous, far bigger than Bitcoin, but just for the whole world, what does that look like for corporations moving forward?
Are there
and governments and any organization?
Are there any analogous business models where someone may give you, I don't know, the first hit for free, and then once you're hooked, say, actually, prices are going to 100x?
Which one?
It was a joke about drug dealers or any unsavory mob-like crime. But yeah, I mean, honestly, and I think this actually raises a couple of other topics. So I think, you know, in the dream world, open source catches up fast enough that you can run all this yourself. And maybe the reality is that for, you know, a company like Block, like 80% of what you need to do, you can do on-prem with open source models. That's great. And maybe you do still need the really good stuff for some things, but that's, you know, whatever, a fraction of your revenue. I think that would kind of be the dream world. Or eventually, you know, just like the mainframe era gave way to the personal computer and then the phone. Eventually, I think that will happen, but it's going to be a rocky transition. What I'm more interested in that medium term, well, actually, then the next question becomes, can one company sustain a lead? You know, in the past, I would have said I doubt it because Google is so good. OpenAI is so good. Anthropic is so good. Elon is Elon. Never count that guy out. Zuck is doing everything he can. But like, I got to say, even though I'm a major Elon bull, and I think in the long run, he controls space and energy. So like, he'll be around. You know, X is not nearly as good. Meta has fumbled the bag increasingly. Google is good, but like it's not caught up with Anthropic as far as I can see. And OpenAI, you're more of the OpenAI expert, but it seems like even they are the closest to Anthropic, but still lagging a bit. So I
don't even know. I'd say it's lagging.
I think they're comparable.
I do mostly Codex these days. I have a Codex, Claude CLI and Gemini CLI open at all times.
Yeah,
and I keep returning more to Codex because it's just like faster, more aggressive, like the It just does a lot more. It's much more capable at the execution side of something. And so I still think it's kind of neck and neck between those two at the moment.
And I'm sure you don't think Google's just going to like roll over.
I would not count DeepMind out.
Yeah.
I would not count them out.
I would easily predict that even in 2026, they'll come out with a model that's superior.
Yeah.
Like it's not forever again. And then Anthropic will come out with a
superior. Kind of a... It's a leapfrog.
But it does, and I agree with that, and we've been watching leapfrogs for years, but at least, let's just use revenue as a proxy, it does seem like Anthropic is breaking out.
But I think when you serve the enterprise and coding use case, and I think OpenAI is becoming convinced at this point too, but like that use case is just such a powerful use case that
more money,
and just even more usage.
Yeah.
Like money, yes, but also like historically we think of like, oh, let's go sell software to the enterprise because they have more money. But realistically, it actually uses the service more. Like
right.
it just plows through tokens. Like any enterprise is going to plow through tokens. Like compared to a consumer
yeah.
equivalent, you're like we all are consumers, so we imagine ourselves, you know, using it. We're like, oh, it's amazing. I use it 50 times a day. But if you have agents, if a single developer has 100 agents running to build a production system, running 24/7,
yeah,
it's just way bigger than any consumer use case could ever achieve.
And as you think about flywheels, I mean, first of all, I have to give huge credit to Dario and team. Like they made a strategic decision to only focus yep. on coding and enterprise when OpenAI was breaking yep, out yep, as the yep. consumer. Like that was a genius move.
Yeah.
It was not just prescient. Like that was like, I mean, that dude has been so spot on over and over. And like, I don't know. Like, I mean, I've met some people in Anthropic. Some are super exceptional. Some I would say are solid. But I don't think they're like whatever exceptional compared to like Google or OpenAI. But that dude, whatever is going on with Dario, like he is a true alchemist in the way he cooks his models, and he's seen the future repeatedly. So I have to give credit where it's due. But the question I want to get into is the flywheels.
Yeah.
So you say OpenAI recognize it. Okay. And I mean, I would never count Sam Altman out yet either. He's got, you know, huge backers, et cetera, et cetera. But like, the thing I question is, if these are recursive loops, the question is what's fed into the recursive loop, right?
Yeah.
So data, chips, power. Maybe there's something else I'm missing, but let's just use that as a rough proxy. The good
maybe,
news.
Yeah, okay.
Well, by power.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So when I think about those three constraints, you know, on the one hand, as you guys know, I'm extremely long and mostly focused on investing in energy at the moment. Okay, I still think Elon has advantage there because whatever, he's the best at that. But that can be solved with enough money. data, the more you have people using you, if you start to have a substantially higher growth rate than everyone else, then your data advantage spins way faster. So that's certainly to Anthropic. And then the chips, that's also a money thing. And it seems like, again, if it's coming down to physical infrastructure, well, if Elon gets the Terafab, then back to Elon. But again, enough money probably can solve that. So I guess the question that I have in my mind is, once one of these flywheels starts spinning, which is most important and can someone catch them or not?
Yeah. Well, I was already going to mention this, but Diana yeah. just said Anthropic may be shooting themselves in the foot with what I'm calling
oh, yeah.
nerfing. But,
yeah.
And so I would say the past week or two, I've seen bearish signals on Anthropic.
Mm.
And I say that in the context of with AI moves so fast that literally week to week, we go from like Cursor is the next big thing right. or Replit's the next big thing to like completely counting them out.
Right.
Like
I think
$1 trillion valuation to zero. That goes over.
That was
over,
93.
And then like OpenAI is going to win or Anthropic's going to win. They're, you know. So it's fast paced and we're changing our minds.
I would never call
on that.
A winner. I would never call yeah. it.
Oh,
yeah, I think it's
now Anthropic yeah. definitely 2 weeks ago, Anthropic was like at a local maxima and
yeah.
very peak bullishness. Every day they're launching new products. They have a killer model. They announced Glasswing and Mythos.
Yeah.
But in the past couple of weeks, they have, I think it's pretty clear, they nerfed their open model, which everyone was loving. And as Diana mentions, there's a lot of hate now. So like people using the product, it's not as good a product anymore. So that hurts their brand. Now, rumors are they're doing that to boost their financials for an IPO. Seems plausible. But it puts into question, like, what is the only reason they are ahead of Google and OpenAI? Because they're willing to have way worse margins. And maybe Google and OpenAI could have done the same thing. Unclear.
Maybe.
Right? So it's not clear to me they have a huge lead. And then also with Mythos, just the name makes it sound mythic, right? And
$10 trillion
and it's super
IPO
scary. And like
up.
The you know Washington D.C. calling all the banks to go meet yeah. and talk about security. But we've also heard reports on like Mythos actually isn't that much better than Public, the pre-nerfed Opus.
So it's the new
and we'll get
kind
it.
Of the quality of Opus pre-nerfing.
There's reports that like if you tune and harness Opus in a certain way, you can match Mythos
okay.
results. So it's and also, is it just a marketing exercise?
Yeah.
So we don't actually know if Mythos is like a huge leap ahead of Opus or other models. It's unclear. So I'm certainly not shitting on Anthropic. they're doing really well. But I'd just say that there's some negative bearish signals the past couple of weeks.
I mean, the thing I would say on that is my guess is they're also getting so much usage that they're probably just like tiering people. And like, yeah. I know that's not great, but like they're probably like tiering certainly consumers but and even enterprise.
It seems like a mistake they made. They should have been public about it and then allowed people to
upgrade,
re-access the good stuff and just pay more. As far as I know, you can't do that. So like, I'll talk about some of the projects I'm aware of. Developers are doing security researchers, but they were using that to find, you know, to do development, find bugs, etc. And now that's been their work's disrupted.
So if that's true, that just leads me to be even more bullish on the chip and energy piece. Because my guess here's my guess of what's happening. No insider info. I'm just guessing. Is that you know, if you listen to Dario, he has not been, and I actually think this is potentially a strategic mistake, as bullish on how much compute they need compared to other labs, right? You got Elon saying, fuck it, I'm building effectively Dyson spheres, we're going all in. And I actually think that's the right approach to win. But that also requires...
Timing matters, right?
Timing matters.
How long does it take to build a Dyson sphere?
It requires like, I mean, basically public markets or private markets, basically it requires just like huge amounts of money that's like, cool, just keep burning, baby, keep burning. I believe you. And Elon probably has more of that goodwill. Google actually has the revenue, so maybe they could do it better. But to Dario's credit as well, I actually think one thing that's underreported that I didn't mention in my flywheel is it appears that they've had less compute in general and have been more efficient with it. So they may also believe they're just better alchemists, and they probably are. But my guess is they still did not expect this much of a breakout. Mm-hmm. And so things are getting away so fast that yes, in the ideal world, they would say, we tier it, you can pay and get more. But my guess is that if like super sensitive things like government and like, I don't know, like the highest of the high-end banking and whatever people are using this, it's just not for sale because it's not available, is my guess.
I want to respond. Matt Coate had a comment that scrolled off now, but he asked, why are the switching costs high for models? This goes back to the conversation
We're still here.
Okay.
Still here. We're back.
Sorry about that.
I believe the competitors to Anthropic shut us down. They didn't want us to.
Yeah. I was just responding to Matt Coates' comment.
It was Mythos. Yeah. It was Mythos. Oh, shit.
Are there switching costs? They don't need to be, but like any good company, you try to build a moat and you try to add switching costs.
Deepen your relationship,
So you can imagine switching costs existing where whether it's the harness, the agent, anything around the model, you optimize for it and you create those hooks. So if you're a naive corporation, you just sort of accept stuff that worked really well from your provider and you don't really know that you're getting, you're increasing your switching costs. So just awareness of that. And the other thing I'd say, I think a smart corporate strategy, or I should say organizational strategy, anyone transforming their organization around AI to reduce this risk of dependency, not only set it up so that you can use multiple frontier models, but also you mentioned the open models. The ideal scenario is open models close the gap, mm-hmm. and it's that obviously has numerous benefits. But even if it never closes the gap, it should always be the case that open models can handle 80% of the tasks, or at least some of your tasks. So as an organization, setting it up so that the open models do perform all the tasks that they're able to for you, that also reduces your dependency from a single company.
Do you think there's a way to build something like, instead of building an open source model, that's happening and like that'll probably continue happening, but like something that I haven't seen, but and what you're saying would make me contemplate, would there be some way to build like an open source memory system so that you can watch how I use, you know, the Claude API and then watch how I use the OpenAI API and sort of aggregate the memory so that you can resubmit parts of the context, make models more...
Well, I think we experienced that with Ori, right? In our group chat, our MDK group chat with Ori, Nick was experimenting with switching out Claude Opus with Kimi or one of the open source Chinese models. And that was that was demonstrative of no switching costs, because it was like it happened in a second. And that when you switch to a new model, it had access to all the memory.
Was that because they built some custom stuff to reset context, or
I think it was
memory
just
portable?
The standard OpenClaw stuff.
It's very funny you mentioned that. I have a founder I'd like you to meet. We were just discussing he's building exactly this last night.
Yeah. But, I mean, I'm always a fan of like, I want this open source vision that we're talking about.
Me too.
But
I want it.
But I feel like when it's too much just, you know, it's like the open source version of the thing that everybody uses, that never feels right to me. I feel like the open source thing, the attack vector, if you want to call it that way, or the defense vector for open source is to be like a layer above or a layer below or a little bit more of a judo type move than like a right up the middle.
100%. You should meet this guy. Okay, we'll follow up after. Yeah. So then there's a bunch of other second and third order implications, which I just can't stop thinking about this stuff, which potentially for 10 days, I won't be able to. It's probably going to be good for me. I'll come back with something deeper than the constant news. But okay, let's just say for a minute, there's competition at the top, but it's, you know, call it 3 to 5 companies. That's it. And they're just doing 80% of all of the revenue in the world or more. And there's a couple of interesting articles and things to explore at that. One thing to explore, which Matt Belez brought up in the chat, which is he was saying, Dan was asking if Replit's still good. He said Replit's good.
Matt Coe said, damn, Max is doing Vipassana, huh? Want to confirm or deny that?
Anicca. but he says the Codex, so he's basically saying that Claude is going to just basically copy and paste Replit. I like Replit. We've been a big fan of Replit. Seen they've raised some flashy valuations. My first question is, let's say 3 to 5 model providers win. Like, is anything safe? Like, you see every single company. It's like, I see all of these companies that are raising money and these great founders and these visions. Right. And I look at them and it's like, I want to believe. I mean, I'm all for entrepreneurship. But like, if everything you're doing is dependent on Claude, and Claude, and I think you said this article, which was phenomenal. I loved it, called The Big Rug, which is just like, and you know, I said it's giving vibes of, you know, good old Zuckerberg days when he was like, hey, I got social security numbers of Harvard guys, and why would they give you that? I don't know, dumb fucks. Like, it kind of seems like we're all playing, I don't know, the exact same story again on steroids as the internet, and you're just giving all your data to Facebook. And this time, businesses are just like, oh shit, Claude is so good. Yeah. Let her rip, baby. And then Claude's just like, thank you for all of your proprietary data for every industry in the world.
We see how your software is built. So we could rebuild it. We know all of your customer service, so we could rebuild it.
We
know
all
your marketing
data
channels, so we rebuild it. Effectively.
I mean, I see that. I'm like,
what do you own? What
is
it?
Is anyone, am I missing something? I'm like, is any of these companies going to survive? When it's like, if they're Replit raising a multi-billion dollar valuation, okay.
Another example
Claude kills
that we've seen is you know, people using AI for like real estate stuff, like you pasting contracts. And so you collect all this proprietary data on pricing and contracts across all these markets, and you do it in a big data way. That would give you an advantage over all the existing real estate companies.
Yeah.
So.
Now, I would have to believe, because I remember, I think it was this story, I don't know if one of you guys shared this ever, but Demis wanted to like basically build like an HFT to go and like eat Jane Street's lunch just to prove he could. And Larry and Sergey are like, nah. Mm-hmm. But like, I got to believe, first of all, I have to believe, I'd be very curious to see what the HFTs like Jane Street's and Hudson Rivers, I assume those guys are not just turning over all their stuff to Anthropic, although I mean, I guess you never know, but I would assume they're probably one of the first leaders.
Their intern was a major investor.
Yeah. Anyways,
SBF.
Yeah, I'm aware. I know what you're saying, but I would have to assume those guys are like the bleeding edge, because I know they have the money and you know, the only maybe companies in the world with talent on par with these like big tech companies. So I would have to believe if you're looking for where open source is going to thrive, or at least on-prem, it has to be those guys, because I just can't imagine they're just giving away all of their proprietary secrets. But if they are, and certainly every other industry is, like, how does Anthropic literally not just like control the entire economy, the entire world economy? And if that happens,
well,
then...
But Anthropic uniquely, or the 3 to 5?
Let's say 3 to 5 companies, but really I mean Anthropic, but sure, the 3 to 5 companies. And I just, like, I don't, like, any startup unless, and this is why I'm super focused on the two things I know that are still scarce in that world, assuming it doesn't somehow get broken, Bitcoin is scarce, and the actual physical assets, the land, energy infrastructure, for a while, the robotics you can still get away with, I think. But absent those things, I just don't see how a single software startup does well. I don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a kind of an emerging...
Or regulatory. If you're like a neobank, like I've invested in a bunch of neobanks. Yeah, yeah. Okay, fine. If you have a license...
But even regulatory stuff, you could probably recreate much faster today than you could have back in the day, right? So I'm mostly on board with everything you're saying. And I think it's not a super contrarian view these days. Like, I think at least... It's an emerging view, let's say.
To be fair, we've been saying this for a while. But.
Yeah. But I'd say it's like an emerging view. I think, I thought I heard somebody say, I don't watch it closely, but I thought Salesforce just had a huge collapse or big haircut in the public markets because people were kind of coming to the kind of that conclusion. So I think if it's like pure software, you probably have a lot of risk like that. But I think there's data centers, there's energy, there's chips. When you have like deeper customer relationship,
yes.
Let's take Square, for example. There's that point of sale terminal sitting on your...
And Proto.
Is somebody going to rebuild and build those customer relationships and deploy those? Like, to me, that doesn't feel like it's as replaceable as Salesforce software.
Yeah. The more hardware there is, the more of a moat you
it's
have.
It's like hardware, the scarcity. You just need that's scarcity somewhere.
We need to get to quantum, but in a future episode, I think it's a really compelling topic about companies that have hardware expertise and being standouts.
Yes.
So like from a pure
that may be the only left.
Yeah. Like, so as an investor. Yeah,
Proto may be the business.
Now. Like an investment thesis would be, well, yeah. I mean, I think Block's super well positioned because there are not many companies in the world that are good at both hardware and software. Obviously, Apple is like by themselves and everyone else is a distant second, but I put Block in the top 10 for sure, if not top 5. Microsoft, Google have emerged over time to have a lot of hardware chops, which they didn't have before. But Block has had hardware and software in its DNA from day one.
Yeah. One last thing I want to mention on this topic, and then we can jump into quantum.
I got one at the end after you, before we move to quantum.
The last thing I was... Return next week for the Presidio AI Jam. Okay, so then the last second, third order consequence that we talked about, and I shared this piece by this the guy, I didn't realize actually, he was Bitcoin dude that started, I think, Bitfury, and is one of the Canadian ETFs, this Mark Vanderschies or something Dutch. But he had a really nice post, which I liked, which was like, okay, let's just assume for a minute, like let's try and like think a few steps out. 3 to 5 companies control 80% of the revenue in the world, 50% of the revenue in the world, some huge number, whatever you want to pick. On the first hand, everyone's like, oh, sweet. This means that, you know, profits are going to, or prices are going to fall. That's good for everyone. And that, stock valuations are just going to freaking soar. And it's like, okay, well, if you own those 3 to 5 companies, yes. And in the very short term, companies are going to come in, use AI, cut, effectively.
Why will
workforce.
Prices fall if there's 3 companies in the world that control everything?
Well, in the early stages. In the early stages, yes.
The prices of the things that those 3 companies are selling, or the price of
the price of global economy. Like basically it's deflationary in that you will be able to do more with less. So the sort of common theme that you'll hear from like Wall Street bros right now is sick. I've got a company, add a little AI, cut my costs, boost my margins, let's go. And in theory, you pass some of that on to the customer, lower prices. Maybe they do, maybe they don't, depending on how competitive the market is. That's the like, okay, sure. That makes sense at first. But then when you start thinking about these other things, you're like, okay, well, first we come in, we help save you, you know, cut your workforce, save, boost your margins. That's all good. Oh, wait, now we just copied you, motherfucker. And you're out. And they just start one by one, like the Grim Reaper, taking these companies out. Then he's like, okay, so if he claims in his piece, 80 to 90% of companies go bankrupt. Public companies are bankrupt. That could be sensationalist. Maybe not. I think the hardware ones are the ones that stick around. But then in that world, then you say, well, what happens next? It's like, if that happens, everyone loses. I mean, most people lose their jobs and the value. I mean, and even stockholders, unless you're holding the right 5 companies, are just kind of like kaputs. His next argument was, and I think you had an interesting take on this. Okay, well, then those companies basically are going to get taxed 80, 90% by governments. And the new social contract is basically turning Anthropic and these companies into public utilities and just redistributing the wealth to like prevent a French revolution.
I mean, that's the other side of that like Department of War comment, right? Like you either nationalize the company or the company becomes the new nation.
Yeah. Well, and that's what you said is like nationalization.
I'm not sure which direction that goes. I'm not. The thing I was going to ask Steve, we have a longstanding.
S&P 500 yeah. index.
Y'all's favorite top.
VOO and chill. Boy. Are we going to VOO and chill? Or?
I'm going to let you guys make out that.
I don't know. I think it reopens in a healthy way this debate. Yep. And I think it's interesting. So we'll talk about it on a bike, okay. Future
I've,
bike
I've,
ride.
I've never been a like DK's commodity a vibes guy. Holder. Like, I mean, outside of Bitcoin.
Yeah, I was about to say, bro.
But like, you know, I don't buy gold or silver or platinum or palladium or whatever people buy.
Jewelry?
But, you know, as an asset to hold. But I do find myself not thinking I want to own them, but that those are the things that are investable assets and revenue generating, profit generating entities don't look so attractive in general.
Not investment advice.
Not investment
advice. But buy Bitcoin.
Well, I mean, and to be clear, even on that though, right? It's like, and I think that's actually assuming, which this is going to be a good transition for you, assuming quantum doesn't break Bitcoin or something, like Bitcoin is the only one that's super interesting because even those other things, yeah, the rare earth minerals are, okay, the compelling short term, but that's all timing. As an investor, I hate trading.
Because
It's like, then okay, but when does asteroid mining take off? When does electrolysis, when we have free solar converting, you know, ore into new kinds of metals? So personally, the only two things that I would have some comfort in, assuming Bitcoin doesn't get broken, is Bitcoin and land.
Land, though, can be taxed.
Yeah.
And the taxes could change dramatically.
All right.
Okay.
Quantum.
Yes.
Because I have been talking, I think since January on the show about Presidio Bitcoin's coming out with a quantum report.
It's been 2 weeks for a while.
It's been 2 weeks for a while.
Yeah.
It finally was published today.
Yes.
So,
let's go, baby.
Yeah.
But I didn't see the Substack.
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe you didn't post it there? Anyway.
Oh, should we guys see the Substack?
It's on X. It's a quantum readiness report that we put out. Our producer, Ashu, right behind me. Led the charge on that. So did, a lot of other people were involved in it. What sets it, there's been, in the past 2 months, there's been like a dozen other summaries of the quantum situation with Bitcoin. So what makes this project stand out? I'd say three things. One, I do think it's a high quality, balanced report. It's it's not overly sensationalized in any direction. It just tries to be at the most unbiased, honest, transparent, comprehensive report as possible. Secondly, it was always intended for both a broad audience, but also investors in particular. We want this to be like the go-to shareable report. So if someone on Wall Street is like, hey, I was going to take an allocation of Bitcoin with my fund, but I heard about this quantum problem. Right. What's the story there? Here's the report. So that's the use case, the primary use case we have in mind. But this applies to your, you know, cousin or friend or anyone who has a natural question because they see it in the headlines and they're like, what's the deal with quantum? Mm-hmm. Is Bitcoin going to die? And the report is packaged up as a PDF with a good visual design, something professional looking that you'd be, you know, confident sharing with someone at BlackRock or whatever. And the third differentiator is that it's, we felt it was important that this isn't just a one-time document because even in just trying to get this out the door, we have had every day there's like some new announcement or report that changes the report. And so what we didn't want is to have a really good report that becomes stale a week later and all of a sudden it was this the go-to shareable and it's no longer. So we're launching it as a public good, an open source project, much like we did with the Bitcoin Consensus Analysis Project. So we welcome anyone to contribute to this report. It's a living document.
It's on GitHub?
It's on GitHub. Yeah, so it's not just a PDF, but it's on GitHub and Markdown.
Is it in the Presidio Bitcoin GitHub?
Do we have a GitHub?
Oh.
Yeah, I believe so.
Oh, nice.
Or how, I forget how do we contribute or...
Yeah, well, I forget the URL offhand, okay. But on our X account, on Presidio Bitcoin's X account is where we announced this okay. project. There's a link to the GitHub there. That's where anyone can contribute. So yeah, you can file issues, you can open up discussions, and you can, of course, contribute PRs as well. And yeah, so it'll be a living document. So we'll keep updating it over time, and then at some kind of frequency, update the PDF as well. I'm still not exactly sure how much lift it is to go from merge to PR into the markdown to the PDF, but hopefully that's lightweight. But yeah, so we're super excited about that. And like, what does it cover? It tries to outline both what is the threat and risk, what's the current activity and what's being done about it. And then also goes through different scenarios on if this does come to fruition over different time frames, what can be done. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, because no one knows anymore. I mean, I see people on Twitter already getting riled up over us couching it as if it will happen, mm-hmm. not when. But it ranges from like 2 years away to 10 years away to 50 to never. I think this covers whichever camp you fall in. I think this project covers that well, in that if it is 20, 30, 50 years away, well, here's a long-term plan to get into a strong position to deal with that. However, if it is one of these shorter-term windows of time, and it is a few years away, or just happens out of nowhere, that there's an outline of a plan of here's what could happen. And of course, this project doesn't dictate what happens. It's not a formula. It's not a guarantee that these are the steps that will be followed, but it just outlines, to the best of our knowledge, what everyone in the space is working on. Here are logical flows of what would happen in these different timeframes. So I think that aids the discussion as well. For anyone who is in the position of like, what can Bitcoin survive? What will it do if it happens in 2 or 10 or 50 years? Well, read this, and do you find it credible or not? It links to a bunch of resources and projects.
I was going to say, there's a lot of people in the quantum, let's say, debate who have a financial interest in quantum happening sooner or later. Like maybe if you run a quantum company or you've invested in it. I think there's always, I mean, I always ask the question of like, what are the incentives and are we seeing the real story and stuff like that? I think, you know, something about this report is there's no sort of financial incentive behind any of the people who contributed to it. But I would guess that there may be people who come in and debate and discuss it or want to sort of merge in different PRs that may have a perspective influenced by their positions. How do you go about kind of, I'd say it begins with neutrality, but how do you sort of maintain that neutrality?
Yeah, well, and with any project like this, you're going to have a set of maintainers for the project, and maintainers are the ones that hit merge and accept mm-hmm. stuff. So I think you know, the project will suffer the biases of the set of maintainers, and it's a responsibility of not only the maintainers but anyone who is engaged in the project and in reviewing to evaluate any kind of change and evaluate on its merits, perhaps try to understand incentives behind the person submitting it. But I mean, it's no different than Bitcoin Core or any project. What if a developer from BlackRock submits a PR to Bitcoin Core? Does that mean it should automatically be ignored or accepted? Neither. It should be evaluated on its merits. So I think that'll hold for this project as well.
And I think it's nice that this is coming out of Presidio Bitcoin as sort of like a nonprofit. I think the incentive is clear. Like, everyone working on a Presidio Bitcoin and funding it wants Bitcoin to like not die. Yeah. So I think that's a very clear incentive.
I'll point out, we are so neutral that even though some of the generous backers mm-hmm. may have a financial interest in other things around it, we will pull no punches, right? Steve has made commentary.
Until we get acquired for $100 million, that is.
but the point being, I think we're really truth-seeking and really don't have a financial interest in...
Other than wanting Bitcoin to succeed.
Yeah, we want to help Bitcoin succeed, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's...
investing in like a
I'm not aware of any contributors to this to the date and the maintainers having equity interest in quantum companies.
Right.
It's probably reasonable to suspect all of us hold Bitcoin and are long Bitcoin. But what's interesting about that is people who are long Bitcoin fall into all these different camps. Mm-hmm. Some are in the hysteria, quantum is going to kill Bitcoin and in a year. We need to act. No one's doing anything. We need to act right away. To there's others who are like, it's FUD. It's physically impossible.
Yeah.
Physics are going to change so to prove that it's impossible. And everyone in between, all of whom are Bitcoin holders. So just being a Bitcoin holder doesn't mean you're going to...
Yeah.
You can't predict where someone's going to land on the quantum debate just because they hold Bitcoin.
So a couple things I want to just mention, and I had the chance to hear some folks talk more about quantum this weekend in sort of the Bitcoin research context. And a couple of my takeaways, which I think dovetail with this report. Number one, I mentioned before, one of my biggest concerns was, is the Bitcoin community embracing AI enough and tracking Anthropic and stuff? I still think, as I mentioned to you guys, one of the top things we could actually do is help more projects, including Presidio Bitcoin and some of these open source maintainers, get hooked up with Anthropic and use more of those tools as they're doing research around everything, including quantum. But two, it seems like we are making great progress on a variety of fronts. Obviously, the blockchain research, it looks like there's going to be some other groups that are doing their own stuff, which is awesome. For like post-quantum resistant cryptography applied to Bitcoin, amazing. That's only going to get more efficient, especially if AI helps there too. The big question that I had that it seems like this report is definitive on is, when I was a bit more concerned about quantum, I was concerned because I thought it would take a long time to move all of the coins that are potentially affected. And I think one of the big takeaways from this report, correct me if I'm wrong, is the 80-20 of value stored in keys that are not quantum resistant could be moved in like a day. Is that true?
Yeah. And the report walks through the math.
We
talked about
this
on the show too. My instincts were that that was the result. And now we actually have real numbers behind it. But in some kind of event where there's a mad rush.
Like break glass. Oh shit, the quantum computer is here right now.
Yeah. I mean, so in the extreme, if it's here right now, well, then it's... it opens up questions though. How much does it cost to crack a key? I mean, it might be here right now, real, but it takes a year and $100 million.
Yeah. Right.
Well, then you still have time. But if we're in the most extreme scenario where it's cost nothing, it's real time breaking, well then even that is not enough. I mean, then you're in a situation where you're like the Bitcoin ecosystem will come to a consensus saying this was the last valid block. We're going to update all the systems and then name something better.
Yeah, what's
that.
The better?
I'm not saying it's good. I'm saying name a better solution than that.
You do nothing.
but then one person has all the Bitcoin. I mean,
it's like, whichever.
Well, no, anyone who spends Bitcoin is going to.
Oh, if you could do it that fast. Well, then
real time. So I'm saying the extreme scenario.
Even in the extreme scenario, my intuition, I'm open to whatever, would be that the attacker keeps stealing it until people stop. And then an upgrade is rolled out for the new signature scheme. But people that keep using the old signature scheme.
But the attacker would have like 6.5+ million Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty hard in the camp of you do nothing to ever change the old coins.
Opens up the debate too about what to do with vulnerable coins. Do you freeze or let them be stolen?
Let them be stolen.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of people feel differently
that's
about that. We can't have a discussion here where we conclude like this is definitely the right answer to either of those questions.
Right.
But I am quite certain there'll be hot topics.
I'm sure there will be hot debate
in the report. Talks about the hot topic of what to do with Satoshi coins.
Yeah.
And the same would apply to this extreme situation where it catches off guard, it's real time, it's cheap, and do we reorg around a block? I think that'd be a super hot topic.
But that's super unlikely.
Most extreme scenario.
Yeah.
Much more likely ones are there's time. And yes, most of the value could move in a day.
In that extreme scenario, okay, the attacker gets $6.25 million, it tanks the price short term, but like the community does not fork because the whole ethos is no forks. Like, we'll never Ethereum this. How quickly, like, what would happen if you said, okay, we're not going to force anything, but we want to get the new signature schemes out there for active, for willing participants to use ASAP? Like, how quickly could that be rolled out, the new signature scheme? Like, if break last right now.
Well, again, there's a range, right? I mean, like, let's take the most extreme scenario.
Most extreme scenario.
I don't know exactly the status of the Blockstream work, but let's just say it's been coded.
Mm-hmm.
So in the extreme scenario, even if it's not been like super properly tested and vetted and reviewed, I mean, it could be merged into Core immediately, contact a few mining pools and a few exchanges, and boom, like, yeah, with, you know, within 24 hours. That's certainly not like the healthy way to do it, right. Ideal way to do it. But in some kind of break glass, that could be done. I mean, and history has shown it can be done.
Yeah.
The 2018 inflation bug, that was done within that type of time frame.
Yeah.
It was properly disclosed. There was the ensuing hours after that, a small group of core devs were investigating it, making sure it's true, and then debugging it and figuring out the right solution, and then figuring out how to push changes that would fix the problem, and then contacting pools and getting it upgraded. And that was all done in short order. So then that's been done multiple times in the past.
And to be clear to anyone listening, the reason I'm asking this is I don't think this is a likely scenario. In fact, I think it's extremely unlikely. But it's really nice to be able to say, if you can go to someone who's afraid and they don't understand things and be like, in the 0.001% absolute worst case scenario, even in that scenario, it doesn't kill Bitcoin. Like, is it good? No. If 6.5 million coins got jacked, of course that would tank the price short term. Of course it would be less than ideal to roll out changes before they're really ready. But I think that the point that I want to get across is, even in the just like unthinkable, most horrible thing, Bitcoin doesn't die. And if we've learned one thing about Bitcoin, it's anti-fragile, and like Mt. Gox didn't kill it. All these things didn't kill it. So if the absolute worst scenario thing you can imagine is, let's say, something on like the Gox scale, it's like, okay, sets us back, but Bitcoin goes on.
And can we talk about the... Didn't Lalu drop something?
Yeah, there's at least interesting 4 or 5 new reports that we'll quickly go through.
Yeah.
Well, I'll start with the one that I actually think is the most meaningful report in terms of the likelihood of quantum computing, or the, you know, acceleration of the timeline was the Google paper, the most recent Google paper, which shows that quantum computing has applications to accelerating AI. And I was not aware of that being possible. Mm. I talked to a bunch of people. I asked a bunch of people I know who know something about this world, and it caught all of them off guard. So I've never seen anyone talking about that.
I don't think I even understood. What is it that quantum computing could have applications to
accelerate AI? Yes.
Would that not be presumed?
No one I know thought that was an application.
I mean, isn't AI is just running on a substrate of a computer, and if you can do a lot more with
different, but it's a very different type of computer.
Technology. Yeah. Well, I think it also
so question prior to this paper, I don't think people, I mean, the novelty of this paper was that it showed how it could accelerate AI.
And I'd be curious, I haven't looked at the paper in much detail, what that means, accelerated AI is LLMs and other branch of AI, like what's actually, because like the interesting thing with quantum computers is that they're, like you said, they're kind of like savant, like idiot savants, like really good at certain things, really bad at the things computers are. So
in fact, someone we know who I won't name, but they work for a fund. They just did like a multi-month research project to determine whether their fund should be funding quantum stuff.
Huh.
And that work, and this super sharp person, they did not uncover AI as an application. So that's one of the people I reached out to saying, hey, did you see the Google paper? And that it was news to them. So I don't think it was like well established or known that that was possible. The reason I think it's the biggest announcement is that as we talk about in the show all the time, AI is a big deal.
Yeah.
Trillions of dollars, quadrillions of dollars, whatever. If there's some kind of new capability unlocked to the quantum computer, there's going to be tremendous investment into quantum computing.
Probably accelerates the timeline.
So to the degree, if we assume the physics theory allows for quantum computers.
Yeah.
Or even that the physics could change.
Well, but the current theory suggests it's possible. There are some physicists we know who think that physics will change to show that it's not possible. But it is possible. So it's an engineering problem. To the degree that physics theory is correct today, it's an engineering problem. Arguably a very hard engineering problem. But yeah, if you can accelerate AI, there's going to be way more investment. That, to me, increases the probability and compresses time frames for a viable quantum computer. So I think that's the most notable announcement recently.
Right. I haven't read the paper, but it seems intuitive. Even if there were a new architecture with the best known architectures today of LLMs, they're basically probability matrices, right? And quantum computers basically get to run in a probabilistic way instead of a deterministic way. So it feels...
You missed out. You could have published the paper.
It just feels intuitively like...
Yeah, I don't know the answers.
Surprising that that's the case.
What other alpha do you have cooking in there, DK? what's the next big spill?
We've got other announcements. We got to go through here. And we're down to a few minutes.
You'll have to wait for the next show for alpha.
So another announcement was from our friend Lalu Roastbeef. And he prototyped a concept that we've talked about before in the show, which is... one of the philosophical debates of quantum and Bitcoin is, what do you do with vulnerable coins that don't upgrade, either because laggards or the keys are lost or people are dead or whatever. And so one camp says, don't touch them. That's like Bitcoin ethos. It's by core principles. Don't touch them. Another camp says, well, you're already violating a principle of having your Bitcoin stolen anyway. So let's violate that principle and freeze those coins or burn. But you can also... The flip side of burning is freezing, with the difference being freezing would maybe allow it to be thawed later, such that if I didn't move my coins and then they're frozen, and then in the future I could prove to the world these are my coins, and a quantum computer cannot do that proof. And that would use a zero knowledge proof that I had the seed phrase for that wallet. Mm-hmm. And because a seed phrase to a private key transition is a one-way door that uses a hashing algorithm, quantum can't break that. So we've talked about this on the show before, we've known about it, but Lalu actually went ahead and read the paper that talked about this and implemented it. So it's just another nice progress in the space to, you know, there's papers and then there's code. So it's nice to see Lalu produce the code and actually prove out that it works. He also, through his implementation, demonstrated just how much further work there can be for performance tuning. I think his initial implementation, like the proof, was like over a megabyte, and just through, other contributors reached out to him and helped him tune things. I forget exactly.
Probably like an hour of GPU time or something.
That's another project.
Oh,
so this I think it was on the order of like a couple minutes it took to sign, but then if you went from like 50 seconds to a couple minutes, then you could compress it down from 1.7 megabytes to like 80 kilobytes or something like that. I mean, it's a space time trade-off, but just through like instant reactions from other smart folks that helped him out, he was able to make an improvement on that space-time frontier for this, and it undoubtedly can get better. So that's a nice development. The one you're referring to, I forget who proposed it, but this is like a quantum-safe transaction, which doesn't require consensus changes. So what made this announcement novel is that no consensus changes are made. You can do it today. And so
you have Bitcoin that you want to make quantum resistant. You can
do it today.
And it doesn't require any network consensus upgrades or anything.
Correct.
That's great.
So, which is an amazing property, but like all these things, there's trade-offs. There's no panacea. This is not, I mean, some people are tweeting like this solves the problem. What are we even talking about anymore? But
can it do smart contracts?
It has. it does have, so it's a valuable contribution to this, but it has drawbacks. So what are the, obviously the benefit is like you literally can do it today. Any of us can do it, and we can make our Bitcoin quantum safe. Well, that's amazing. So what are the drawbacks? One is that you It does it by I don't understand all the details, but it makes it so that you're applying a hashing algorithm. I think they chose RIPE-MD 80 or whatever it is, to protect your coins so that a quantum computer can't attack it. But to do so, you have to brute force figure out what the right values are so that you can match your public key. And that is where the GPUs come into play. And so the estimate is something on the order of like $150 to do it. So obviously, if you have a UTXO that's worth $1 million, then who cares about the $150? But if you're a normal user with a wallet that has maybe 10 UTXOs and each of them are on the order of $200 or $300, well, then this is far less interesting. It's not economical and far less interesting.
And can you, if that were the case, could you consolidate them into like a new one UTXO while you're doing this?
Yeah, but you'd still be spending the money. I mean, that money is per key. So if you have 10 UTXOs, sure, you could put them into one, but you're still spending $150 per UTXO. And if each UTXO is worth $150, you end up with no value.
But wait, couldn't you consolidate them first and then do it? So if you had like 10 that are $200 each, you could put them into $2,000.
I guess you could do that. Yep, that makes sense. So the another drawback is that it produces a transaction that is non-standard. And so we've talked about this on the show before. That means it would not be automatically relayed on the Bitcoin network. And I don't think that's likely to change, meaning the reason Bitcoin Core has that relay policy in place is to prevent DOS attacks. And I'm not aware of a way to still prevent DOS attacks while, or not prevent, but like mitigate that risk while allowing this transaction to go through. So that's a drawback, because that means you either have to use a centralized service like Mara Slipstream, or you have to like be buddies with miners in order to get your transaction mined. So that's definitely a drawback. Again, if you're in some emergency situation, or if you're like an exchange, which has like several thousand UTXOs, high value, you can just do a deal. I mean, you just like partner or use the API and make it happen. That makes sense. But for this to be a broader solution for every Bitcoin user, that makes it a lot less attractive. I believe code was produced and it works, but I suspect it's like prototype stage. So would I actually run out and use this right now? No, because I don't think it's an imminent threat.
Prototype is good.
Yeah. It's definitely progress.
And so, prototypes will get better, cheaper, more efficient.
Yeah, so it just need to be productionized to make it safer. But that's another announcement. So very interesting. Let's see. What were the other ones? I guess the last one, which I don't really understand at all, is CSU Wildcat.
I thought we were going back to basketball because CSU beat us last year. I was like, oh no.
That's his X handle. Daniel Burr.
Yeah, Daniel.
proposed something which I can only describe at a high level, and I might even get that wrong. but I believe it allows you to use something in TapScript in the Taproot protocol script scheme. You can use like a TapScript bit or aspect. Somehow you can signal in a transaction that you want to be quantum proof. And then for a future, if you assume a future new signature that is quantum resistant, then it would allow that transaction to upgrade.
Yeah.
Something like that. So I could be wrong. I think what it means is like it kind of allows you to opt in now at no cost to say, I'm cool with a future fork that makes my Taproot spend freezes the standard path for the Taproot spend. I'm cool with that because I've given you permission to use this other tap leaf, which is using a quantum resistant spending path.
So before, I mean, that's interesting. I'd like to look into more of that, but two more basic questions. One of my understandings was that any taproot address today is not quantum resistant. Is that correct? And the second question is, with the signature schemes we're exploring, and maybe this is what Daniel's trying to like get at, would we lose taproot and all of the features that taproot brings us if we were to go to, say, Blockstream's new signature scheme tomorrow in the break glass scenario?
Yeah, so for those not familiar with Taproot, it's just one way to receive and then spend your coins. Benefits, it provides, you can have many different ways to spend your Bitcoin.
It's more conditional, like more like...
It's more conditional. So contract. You might have it where, we might have one where each of us hold the key, and if all three of us sign, it's like a three of three, that's the primary way to spend. But then there might be escape hatches, which is like, well, with a time delay, only two of the three of us have to spend. Or another spending condition is like, oh, well, if you can use a much more expensive quantum signature to spend, which we wouldn't want to use today because it's really expensive, but we have that there in the future in case the other spending paths are nullified. Then we still have that path. So that's what makes Taproot not quantum safe is the called the key spend, like the primary spending path, the cheapest path exposes the public key. And that's what makes it vulnerable. But some of the proposals are to, if there is a quantum computer threat in the future, make that unspendable, but the other paths are spendable.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. And how would that would be like a soft fork, or how would that get activated?
That would be a soft fork. So that, I mean, and then it gets back into the controversy. It's controversial because like some group of people are deciding we're going to make it so you can't spend coins in a way that you were guaranteed in the past.
If someone is concerned about this stuff, so like the most obvious, I know NVK had a big thread on this that you shared that got a lot of love, like, and his like TLDR is like, if you're concerned about this, start with your own stuff. And just like, if you have stuff that's like exposing your public key, probably move it. Does that mean, and I don't even know which services use, I mean, this would be good, like a service for someone to provide or an AI to provide, which services even use Taproot addresses? I assume most do at this point, but I don't know, like does Block or Cash App? And does that mean we should be concerned using, like spending Bitcoin at all from services that are using Taproot right now?
I still don't think quantum is like some imminent risk.
Yeah.
I allow for it. It could be. So I love the planning being done.
Yeah.
I love the scenario planning of these different time frames, and then it's well thought out. I think that's like prudent and responsible because we all want Bitcoin to succeed. But I personally wouldn't, especially for like a
smaller
spending wallet or a hot wallet. Like sure, an exchange might be using it to receive, but they're spending quickly too. Now, if you have cold storage where you're not touching it for decades kind of situation. I don't know. I haven't really thought that through, but also the benefits to Taproot for that scenario are less as well. But
like as a clear example, like something like BitKey, is that if you're say storing their medium amount, is that a concern with Taproot today?
Well, BitKey doesn't use Taproot today, although BitKey wanted to use Taproot and still probably does want to. I don't know. I mean, today, if you lose your hardware device and you buy a new one, well, it requires an on-chain transaction to sweep that wallet to the new wallet, right? Well, today that costs like 50 cents or whatever, but there's a future where that costs $50 or $100,
right?
Well, if you're paying $100 for a hardware wallet and then you have to double the price just to sweep the wallet,
I get it.
Well, if you use Taproot and Frost and you can upgrade the signatures in a secure way without doing on-chain transaction, you've halved the cost of the product.
Yeah.
That matters.
Yeah. No, I get it.
But
it also matters if you like have like, you know, I don't know, $20,000 or something on there. Sure, and it's like, oh shit.
Okay. Well, okay. But then it gets into if all the customers can spend half, if they get a 50% discount today on the product, and one, they think the probability of quantum event in the near term is infinitesimally small, And two, if they have confidence that Bitcoin will upgrade properly and the BitKey product will upgrade properly
to save them,
then why wouldn't they want to save 50% today?
Yeah.
So I don't think it's fair to just say like, oh, everyone avoid Taproot. You can deliver real benefits today. You can still be safe in the future, either because quantum doesn't happen in the future or Bitcoin upgrades safely, mm-hmm. including Taproot, which is, again, part of this report. Part of the plan is that you're not SOL if you use Taproot. You would get upgraded and it sounds like
there's other options like what Daniel's working on too.
Well, and BIP360 is a variation of Taproot, which is a new output type, but it's basically Taproot BIP360 does not define a quantum resistant signature, but it's basically Taproot without the drawbacks and support to quantum signature. It comes with a little bit more cost in terms of number of bytes, so the transactions cost a little more, but that's also mentioned in the report and part of the potential plan too.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're
already over, but
ready. We're way over. We're 10 minutes over. So when that's ready, you'll hear about it here.
Yeah. Catch us back for some DK Alpha.
All right. See you guys.